Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business. My name's Patrick Gray. This week's episode is brought to you by Panther. And Panther can hook you up with a platform that does detection as code on massive amounts of data. And you can find them at panther.com. Panther's founder, Jack Naglieri, is this week's sponsor guest, and we spoke with him about some common detection as code approaches. That interview is coming up later. But before then, we're going to check the week's security news with Adam Boileau. And Adam, I guess we should start this week by saying, oops, a bit of a mea culpa. We did a server upgrade late last week, and we made a change to the RSS feed that we didn't entirely plan, which was it basically appended forward slashes to all of the podcast GUIDs, which for most podcatchers wasn't a problem, but a bunch of people using stuff like Pocket Casts and whatever, those clients decided to re-download the entire Risky Business podcast catalog.
Oh dear.
Sorry about that.
Sorry about that, everyone. And I don't know. We've got some good new features in our upgraded server, like dark mode for our content management system, which is very nice. But yes, unfortunately, that seems to have resulted in quite a few gigabytes of podcasts. So yeah, yes. Sorry about that.
Yeah, it was a busy day for the old CDN. Yes. Can't wait for the bill. But yeah, we just wanted to say sorry to everyone who that impacted, because yeah, a few people were having a bit of a WTF moment when all of a sudden their podcatchers tried to download the last 150 podcasts in both our feeds onto their...
Yes, whoopsie.
Onto their devices. Anyway, let's get into the news and let's talk about the Panageddon. I'm talking, of course, about the CVSS-10 in Palo Alto Networks appliances, like current versions. It's not a memory corruption bug. The bug itself is actually kind of cool. There's been a lot of freaking out about it, and it is bad, but you know, based on our research, we think we might actually skate on this one with limited impact. But let's start with the bug. Tell us about it.
Some researchers, I think Velexity, in the wild saw some attackers compromising Palo Alto devices. And they are thinking, you know, nation state based on the, you know, on where they were seeing this kind of pretty limited exploitation happen. The bug turns out to be kind of path traversal in the value of a cookie. So that cookie, you send a cookie to the web interface of your Palo Alto when you're logging into the VPN, and it writes a file onto the file system of the underlying firewall. That file name, it turns out, you can put dot dot slashes in and write the contents, or write a file outside of where it would normally store cookies. Now, arbitrary file write as root, arbitrary file name write as root is a difficult thing to turn into a shell. But the attackers in question did find a way to do it, where the file names are processed by a script that reports telemetry back to Palo Alto, and that will fall for a shell meta character injection and onwards to command execution. So we've seen quite a lot of, you know, good quality memory on, you know, InfoSec Mastodon.
Yeah, how it's a dot dot slash, but it ain't quite.
It's not your grandpa's dot dot slash, right?
It's not your grandpa's dot dot slash, right? And the thing that struck me about this is, you know, okay, the original, like, arb write with the dot dot slash, that would have been reasonably easy to find. Like, if you're kicking this thing around, you start looking at those cookies and you're like, well, what if I do this? You know, I can see how that would be easy to find. But turning that into reliable, like, CVSS-10 exploitation through this telemetry thing, like, it meant whoever did this had a Palo Alto box. They were putting some time into really understanding how it worked. So, you know, it does suggest that whoever did this had the time to actually bother with all of that.
Yeah, yeah. This is the bug that you wouldn't have found without having a Palo Alto on the bench to play with. And whether it's a virtual one or whether it's a physical one, like these days virtual appliances do make that kind of research more straightforward. But, you know, getting to the point where you've got a shell on one of these things so you can inspect how it works, and then, you know, instrument weird stuff that you might find. Like, so you might have found this bug through fuzzing, right? If you were fuzzing the web interface, you see weird files get written in the file system, then you have to track back to where it's written. So that's, you know, it's not difficult to find, but then turning it into now what is a bit more fiddly. And we've seen, you know, heaps of other appliances like this. If you are in a position to get inside of them and look at their gubbins, often you will find these types of bugs. So, you know, having a research lab with these devices on the bench for you to work at is a pretty good place to find high impact bugs, but it is a bit expensive if you need actual physical devices and a plurality of firmware versions and so on.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess what we're saying is it's not as dumb as it first looks. It's still pretty dumb.
But
don't get us wrong. It's still pretty dumb, but it's not quite as dumb as it looks. Now, the mitigation advice that initially came out of Palo Alto. Now, keep in mind that, you know, there was no patch for this thing, right? So the best they could do is say, well, here's how you mitigate it. You turn off the telemetry. And, you know, that was the first thing that occurred to me as well. Well, you just stop that from happening and then people can no longer, you know, get shell. But of course, it doesn't solve the underlying Arbright bug. So we're already seeing that mitigation being bypassed in the wild.
Yeah, already. Finding another avenue to turn controllable filename write as root into, like, there was always going to be other ways to do it. And I think, like, I do feel a bit for Palo having to walk that line of having a mitigation option to give people so they feel like they're doing something, but also in the case of the attackers they had seen, it would have been effective, but without giving away where the actual bug was, right, which is in a different component and by their powers combined, etc. So, you know, it was a little bit weaselly, but I think given the trade-offs that they had to make, right, it's under active exploitation. We've seen a bunch of interest from people in this bug. Like, it's got a lot of traction. Everyone was looking around for proof of concepts to understand what it was. Weirdly, since the patch has dropped and people could reverse them and figure out what the bug was, like, I was looking at Grainoise this morning and there hasn't been a massive uptick, which I'm kind of surprised by. Like, I was...
Well, I mean, as you say, there's been plenty of people trying out the fake exploits, right? Like fake POX and whatever. So, you know, Grainoise et al. Picking that up. I should correct myself too. I kept saying arbitrary file write, but it's not. It's the file name.
So arbitrary file name, but not arbitrary contents.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes, yeah, exactly. But the file name gets it done because that's enough to bust through that script. Yeah, and
shell meta character injection in the file name, which, you know, thanks.
It's like Shell Shock, but dumber.
Yes.
Actually, it's hard to get dumber than Shell Shock.
That was pretty dumb, anyway. Yeah. I mean, you know, overall, writing cookies to the file system without sanitizing it or storing it as like a hash or whatever else, like, it's a dumb bug and you would expect better from a security appliance.
Well, but, yeah.
You know, it's not as bad as the memes on InfoSec Mastodon made out.
No, but I mean, here we are, right? And I remember, what was that, October, November last year when that Citrix bug landed. And it was immediately obvious to me and to plenty of other people that that was going to be a ransomware palooza style festival, right? Like, that was absolutely going to be a pylon. Now, even though these Palo Alto boxes are generally domain joined, it's still fiddly, isn't it? Like, you're still going to have to know what you're doing to use this bug, get access to the Palo Alto device, and then from there pivot into the Windows network and onto Great Victory. It's not straightforward.
I mean, it's once someone's done it and publicized a path through, then it's probably doable, but I imagine there are going to be a few wrinkles, right? I mean,
I'm saying it's hard for somebody who's like a run-of-the-mill ransomware affiliate idiot. So instead of landing on a Citrix box where everything's right there, this requires extra steps that requires people to actually know what they're doing. That's more what I mean. I'm not saying, oh, it's impossible to go from a pan to it, you know. There's not research that's going to be involved there, just you, you know. Well, somebody knows what they're doing.
Yeah, no, I mean, I agree. Like, landing on a Citrix Windows desktop is a pretty familiar environment for most people, much less specialized than having to pivot through a pan. I'm also not, you'd have to go workshop up how are Palo Alto domain integrations done for auth? How do you steal the creds? How do you pivot onwards? What privs are typical for a Palo auth integration? Like, so these are things that systems integrators and people will be able to answer very quickly. You know, for me as an outsider who hasn't maintained a whole bunch of pans, like, I don't know the answer to those questions, and getting to the point where you can answer that question is going to take a bit of work. So yeah,
but I guess what we're saying here is it's not, you know, we're not guaranteed to see ransomware affiliates going ape shit with this one, right? Like, it's entirely possible that part of the, you know, edge device CVSS10 circle of life will be avoided.
I mean, I think it'll happen eventually, but hopefully it will happen a little bit after people have passed, as opposed to while people are still scrambling to get patches. And indeed, Palo has been providing patches for older but still maintained releases over time. So there's a window whilst we understand the bug, but slightly older point releases of the software are not yet patched. And so hopefully it takes longer than, you know, the week or so that Palo has got to do all of the testing and stuff for the older builds, and people can start applying.
I thought this only affected like 11 up and not 10, or I don't even know. I'm not a, you know, I'm not that deep in the weeds on Pan, same as you, right?
Pan says it goes back to Panos 10.2, but not earlier than that, so 10.1. Yeah, right. But there are maintenance releases of 10.2, 11, 11.1.
And speaking of patches, are patches available yet?
Yes. So they've released patches, but they released it for the most recent version on the 14th.
Okay, right. So they focused on the current, because they can say to people running the older one, just go, come on, upgrade.
Yeah.
If they're already on 11.
And they're only talking like days difference. So like every day since they dropped, they're releasing a couple of versions worth of updates.
I guess the reason I'm talking about this from a ransomware perspective too is because, you know, we've been talking about how the whole ransomware ecosystem is going through some changes. It's in, you know, this weird sort of flux state. And I just don't think we're going to divine any insights from this episode. You know, if it does pass without ransomware actors hammering it, I don't think that's evidence of tremendously successful disruption. I just don't think it's going to tell us anything. I think this is like very much, you know, you've seen China in your pulse secures kind of thing. That's what this feels like to me.
It does feel like it's, you know, was a pretty rarefied bug for a while, and now we're just in a kind of a race to get it fixed, you know, and maybe we'll win that race for once, maybe we won't.
Yeah, indeed. And we've linked through to a story from The Record by John Grieg. We've also linked through to Palo Alto's advisory, and we also have a link to some work out of Rapid7 looking at this exploit. So people who are interested in finding out more can go to the show notes for this podcast and check them out. Now, look, you know, it's so funny, right? Because last week we were like, gee, pretty slow week. And then I think it was like the next day, like all hell broke loose. Shouldn't have said it, right? Just shouldn't have said it. But the other big thing that happened since we last spoke, Adam, is the Sisense breach.
Yes, we saw an advisory from CISA talking about a breach at Sisense, who make, you know, kind of like enterprise analytics products. So you buy a, you know, product/service from them, you glue it into a bunch of your business systems, and it gives you, you know, analytics about your service or your environment or whatever else is going on. And to do that, it has to have access to get that data. And that means credentials and tokens and remote access and all sorts of things from Sisense's platform into all sorts of businesses. And the scale of those businesses and the, you know, there's quite a lot of very big ones that use this service made this more concerning than your average vendor data breach. The backstory is that Sisense were running GitLab, the kind of open source Git, you know, host your own GitHub kind of clone. And that has, you know, a pretty checkered security history. Someone shelled that, pivoted from there into an S3 bucket inside Sisense's AWS environment, and that was filled with all sorts of wonderful loot and booty and thousands of customers' worth of creds.
Just to go back a second, was this a breach or was this just an exposed bucket? Because I'm still not entirely clear on whether or not someone actually got this loot or if it was just left lying around then someone noticed.
No. So my understanding, based on Krebs's reporting, is that it was a bug in GitLab that then gave them the necessary access or tokens or whatever to get access to the S3 bucket that contained the data. So I think it was a two-step thing, not just a left lying around on the internet. That's nice, I guess. Doesn't really help the customers, of course. So we've seen them, the Sisense out communicating to their customers about what to do here. The real challenge for people is that this stuff is super deeply integrated with people's business systems. And it's not like just change the passwords that have been exposed. Like we're talking API keys and LDAP credentials and, you know, web tokens and all sorts, you know, certificates even, you know, whether it's SSL or X509 certs involved in the auth process, actually changing all of the things, like database passwords, where they like straight up ODBCing into people's databases to get the data out. Like that is a lot of things to roll creds for. So for the customers, big deal.
And I think you alluded to it just then, which is that, you know, really this company walks into the crown jewels, right? Of all of these orgs. And yeah, that's a bad thing to get popped.
It really is. So you can see why there was a lot of concern about it. And depending on how widely dispersed the data gets. So this could have quite a long tail because changing this stuff is difficult. And the guidance that SciSense's CISO sent out in an email, you know, lists all the things that customers should do. And it's a huge list. And yeah, all of them are hard. So, yeah, rough times.
Christian Vasquez over at Cyberscoop has a great report here about the political hot water United Health Group is in following the ransomware attack against its subsidiary Change Healthcare. Yeah, this is interesting because it turns out the merger, well, the acquisition of Change Healthcare by United was already controversial. It was opposed by the Department of Justice because they were saying, hey, you know, we're sort of concentrating too much, too much healthcare, you know, too many healthcare services with this one organization. That turned out to be, a founded concern just on security grounds, like not even, you know, forget about competition and whatnot. But I think I find this interesting because it looks like this whole thing has gone political.
Yeah, which, I mean, it's probably good that it has. I mean, the fact that there was a vendor this big in the middle of so many places. And one of the things the story kind of illustrates, I guess, is that, you know, there were downstream users of Change Healthcare that didn't even understand that they were, you know, that they were impacted by it because, you know, there was a couple of levels of you know, indirection between them and Change. And, you know, it was just so much to put in one place, and that kind of happened without people necessarily understanding. Clearly the regulators understood a little bit, but it's a good reminder that this kind of vertical integration, you know, does come with a whole bunch of risks, not just benefits or, you know, cost savings or whatever else there's used to justify it.
Yeah, I mean, Anna Eshoo, the subcommittee ranking member for the Energy and Commerce Health Subcommittee, said that, you know, this amounts to a national security risk, right? Because it's just the scale of it. And as a single point of failure, it's pretty bad. So, you know, maybe they can think about where to fix this problem in other areas before there's gigantic ransomware attacks. It also comes back to that thing that you and I have said on this show many, many times, which is everything is critical infrastructure, really.
Exactly, yes. And thinking about critical infrastructure and the fact that everything is critically and with an eye to how does this look to an adversary, what is this and what leverage does this provide over us, is a thing that's beyond healthcare, it's beyond, you know, cloud services, right? It's beyond things like Microsoft. Like, these are problems that we need to face, you know, in how the economy works, right? It's not just a technical issue or a security issue.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, look, let's have a look at this Wired piece by Eric Geller, who's filing for them these days. He's written a piece just about Microsoft and the way that it prefers to sell security products rather than fix the security problems in its products. I mean, it's stuff that we've talked about on the show many, many times. But here it is in black and white. And it's like he really ripped him a new one. And I feel like the release of the CSRB report has kind of changed the vibe on Microsoft a bit, right? Like, I feel like things are kind of turning around to the point where Microsoft's deficiencies are getting more attention. And I just think this story is a great example of that. Because as I say, he really ripped them a new one.
Yeah, no, he did a great job. I quite enjoyed it. It was a good read. And he makes a couple of what I thought were just really good, you know, obvious but good points, you know, and good journalism often does, you know, say the thing that's on everybody's mind, but it makes it very explicit and clear. And one of them was, when was the last time you saw this happen to Amazon or Google?
Right? Well, Google? I mean, you and I were talking about that, and I thought the Page Thompson, you know, metadata service thing was probably a reasonable example of something clunky in AWS that was an example of like bad product, right? But they seem to have actually fixed things as a result of that. So it's a little bit different, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think back, like, Google Aurora is the last time I could think of Google getting really, you know, badly spanked. And I'm sure they have other incidents that they've managed to keep, you know, more low-key. But compared to, and like, the Page Thompson thing, and indeed the whole design of the AWS EC2 metadata service was dumb to start with.
Yeah.
But that's still a long way from SVR has global admin inside Microsoft, or Chinese.
Yeah, NSS, I mean, I guess what I would say though is that AWS, you know, doesn't offer productivity suites, and you don't OAuth, and you know, so it is a little bit different there. But you know, Google offers roughly equivalent services, and you don't hear about people OAuthing their way to an entire workspace, you know, super admin by just getting people to authorize a couple of apps, right? So, it is certainly, certainly Microsoft looks the worst of the three.
Yeah, it's good to see some criticism of Microsoft, you know, really picking up the pace. The CSRB report, I think, has given a lot of people license, to wave sticks at them, which is exactly what we want, of course.
Yeah. Now it's over. Finally, it's over. The 702 reauthorization has gone through Congress, and now it's with the Senate. This was just a saga, wasn't it?
It has been a very long time coming, and I know, you know, I edit the news that comes out of Catalan, you know, three times a week, and the amount of times that there's been here is the latest, you know, blow by blow about 702, and we go, like, okay, I mean, it's important, but we don't, you know, let's just bin that one for today, because, you know, call me when it's actually passed or actually failed. And at least now it's passed one of the two steps involved. But, you know, the urgency that, you know, because there's a drop dead date coming up real soon, like they're going to have to move. And I think, you know, maybe we'll see a return to it. But it's weird watching this become such a political football, right?
Yeah. When
really it's a key thing for the intelligence community, and the intelligence community is important for US national security overall. Like, this shouldn't be a thing that has become a political football, but the fact
I think there's, you know, I mean, we saw with the FBI being a bit YOLO with their queries that there's room for reform, right? Yes. But if you want to reform something like this, you don't try to do it like 2 weeks out.
Because it is complicated and nuanced, right?
There's
so many other uses of stuff collected under this authority that are, you know, way more important than, you know, the relatively small scale of abuses that we've seen. So
exactly. And they've even expanded some authorities, well, some uses here. So the warrant requirement didn't happen, that was never going to happen, but the, you know, and you and I were talking about this before we got going, like, I think a lot of people sort of don't realize that the 702 data set is quite constrained to begin with, because it's tasked by NSA and, you know, and friends, and, you know, they're really looking for those national security threats. And so, okay, maybe some data gets incidentally collected on Americans or whatever, but it's not the purpose of the program. It's quite a constrained data set. I don't personally believe that FBI should just be able to YOLO search information about, you know, American citizens unless they have a bloody good reason. And I think they could use some more oversight there. It doesn't look like that's really happened. But, you know, they've suggested some new uses here could be, you know, when someone's applying for a visa to the United States, maybe just see if they're in the 702 data set. Because if you are in that data set to begin with, like, that's probably a bit of a red flag. You might be in there innocently, but they'll be able to tell, right? So I think using information like that for that purpose is entirely what it's for.
Yeah, I mean, if you're going to collect all of that data, then you're supposed to use it to make good choices, right? Make good decisions, et cetera,
while protecting the rights of your citizens.
Yes, because, I mean, this data, this authority is for collecting data about foreigners.
And yeah.
The vast bulk of the data is going to be about foreigners like you and I. Well,
yeah.
Maybe Five Eyes, so a slightly different class of foreigner, but, you know, we're still foreigners.
When I go to renew my media visa, which I'm going to have to do, I think, at some point, which means flying to Sydney and going and getting grilled by some really horrible person because they're not very polite at the embassy. you know, if they want to throw my name into the 702 data set, I mean, that's their prerogative, right? It's their country.
Yeah. It's their country, their data. But so it's just weird that so much focus being put on domestic use of this when it's really not the primary use case, or, you know, it's very throwing the baby out with the bathwater kind of situation.
People get real binary, but I mean, we even had this case where was something I wrote wound up on Hacker News recently, and people are like, oh yeah, risky business is great. And then of course there's a few people who are like, yeah, but that guy's like so pro, you know, pro spy, pro NSA, man, you know? And it's like, I don't know. I think really once you drill down into looking at how this stuff is used, you know, find me the abuse, really. Like, the FBI stuff was more like how would you put this? We're sort of against the spirit of the thing rather than being like abuse, if that makes sense. I worry much more about like state police, and in the case of the United States, even like county police and whatever, getting their grubby mitts on all sorts of data sources. I just don't worry so much about the intelligence agencies because they are pretty well overseen anyway.
Yes. And yeah, lots of oversight. And ultimately, they're professionals, you know, in a way that, you know, maybe small town cops, not so much.
Yeah, exactly. No offense to the cops in my area. Now, let's have a look at what's happening in Poland at the moment. I think we've touched on this briefly before, that the new government there is still looking into how the previous government was using tools like NSO's Pegasus on, you know, political opponents, journalists, whatever, domestically. And yeah, we got some numbers behind that now. The Polish government now says over 500 people were targeted by Pegasus within Poland.
Yeah, I mean, that's quite a bit bigger than, like, because previously we had seen some kind of indication of, like, number of victims that were, like, in the, you know, like, 30, for example, so tens. And 500 is pretty significant. Like, and there was a some detail here about, you know, like, the leader of the opposition party and all sorts of other pretty high-profile targets. And it's nice that the new Polish government, and of course, I guess there's political reasons for them to be doing this, are really going to, you know, hunt this down and make an example out of it, because we have seen Pegasus used, you know, in other governments in the EU, and there being a, you know, a pretty solid public example of getting spanked as a result of that, I think is good. You know,
for yeah, I mean, people are going to be in trouble for this, and that's good. But I think one thing that's interesting here is, do you think this would have happened if they had to rely on a domestically engineered capability? And I think it's, you know, it is almost a case where the availability of the tool just in and of itself kind of encouraged the abuse, you know, and I find that an interesting thing to ponder.
Yeah, and I think, like, especially in light of, you know, when NSO Group was kind of at its peak and was arguing, hey, we've got an ethics committee and we only sell to trusted Western governments and whatever else, and, you know, they were trying to make hay out of that. And, you know, in what world would Poland have not been an acceptable customer for them? Like, no, you know, regardless of some of the shadier people they sold it to, like, you would have thought an EU government would be a safe place. But then, as you rightly point out, the availability of the tool is just too tempting for people who can get it. And they would not have stood up a domestic capability to build this just for this, right? It's too expensive, too niche. You know, there would have been too many moving parts to do that quietly. Whereas just buying this and then a little bit of, you know, slipping some numbers into the
and giving it to your favored tempting. Your favored security service and away you go, right?
Yeah. Versus if you had to build it all, then that would be a much bigger project. So yeah, I think you're right that the availability makes this kind of abuse happen.
Yeah, and I think that's why you've got things like the PEGA Commission and stuff in the EU really having to think about this. I mean, I would have been sympathetic to that argument in countries that didn't have the money or the expertise to develop this stuff, but it never occurred to me that even in the countries that do have the money and the expertise to do this, the fact that they can do it sort of quietly by just acquiring it, that does really change the dynamic. So I think all of this work that's going on in various international fora around spyware and the spyware market, you know, I think it's really important work. I do.
Yeah, no, I agree completely. Because, I mean, clearly Poland has a lot of very smart, you know, computer nerds, and they absolutely could build this kind of thing domestically, but you couldn't do it quietly.
Yeah.
You know?
So, yeah, that's right. Well, it's all blowing up on them anyway, so that's something. Meanwhile, staying with spyware, Apple has notified people in, what is it like, 92 countries that they've been subjected to attacks from mercenary spyware, which tells us a few things. Tells us that Apple's telemetry is actually pretty good. And I saw a couple of journos on socials saying, wow, you know, I had no idea that, you know, Apple's telemetry is good. It's like, trust me, if you talk to anyone in that game who, like, works on exploiting iOS, they know how good Apple's telemetry is, because I think we talked about this last week. Like, if you crash an iPhone, like, that crash dump's going to a team of very smart analysts to pick it apart, right? So, yeah, so someone messed up, I guess. Oh, and they can push out detections. Like, they've got really good instrumentation in iPhones. So if they, you know, discover one infection somehow, someone else brings it to them, Citizen Lab, whatever, and there's some sort of artifact they can check for, they can push out a detection for that. And they just do it all very quiet. But yeah, it looks like they rolled up, hundreds of, notified hundreds of people that they had been impacted here. And interestingly enough, and Reuters has taken note here that they're using the term mercenary spyware. They're not using the term state-sponsored. And that's because well, Reuters thinks that that's because the Indian government has been pressuring them on that language. And I find that very interesting.
Yeah, that is an interesting nuance, because obviously, you know, amongst the 92 countries would have been some, you know, Indian users. And the, you know, state-sponsored, if you received that message from Apple and you were in, you know, opposition or in political opposition in India, like, you could see how you could very much draw the line between, well, there's only one state that cares about me, it's, you know, the actual government of India, you know, and that may in fact be true, but, you know, Apple doesn't want to be the one saying that, and clearly they have been, well, Reuters' assertion that they have been perhaps pressured to alter that wording to make it a little less, you know, a little less spicy. But, I mean, you know, given we were just talking about political opposition being spyware, you know, not unbelievable.
But, you know, Modi, I mean, he wouldn't do anything untoward. What are you talking about?
Well, yes. And then, of course, there's the wrinkle that since China is a hard place to do business in these days, Apple makes quite a lot of phones in India. So,
yeah,
it's complicated.
It is, you know. I mean, it used to be the thinking that if you manufacture somewhere, you have leverage over them. But it turns out it's the other way around. So that's interesting. Now let's talk bugs.
Bugs.
Adam. And we got one in a Delinea secret server, which is a authn/authz bypass. I haven't really looked into this one. You put it in there and I'm like, is this interesting? And you're like, yeah, it stays. So take it away, Adam. Tell us about this one.
So Delinea, which used to be Thycotic, make secret server, which is their privileged access.
Okay, I know Thycotic. I just hadn't heard of Delinea.
Yeah, so they renamed themselves a little while ago now. So this is a thing that you store your credentials in and put on the internet, and they run a cloud version of this if you don't want to run it yourself and put it on the internet. So the impact of any bugs in this are not great, and this bug was honestly pretty dumb. It's a bug in the like SOAP interface, but net result is you can steal creds out of the thing that stores creds, and because it's also does like you can proxy connections through it, so you can use it as the kind of gateway onto your on-prem environment or whatever else for auditing reasons. So having access to this thing, you know, could get you remote access. It certainly gets you creds. So this ended up being dropped after they tried to report it for a couple of months via, eventually they went through their local cert instead. So big old disclosure mess, big old bug mess. And the impact if you're a user of Secret Server is pretty rough.
Yeah. Now the other bug we're going to just quickly mention is one in PuTTY. And for those who don't know, PuTTY is, well, I'm guessing most people listening to this know, but some wouldn't. PuTTY is like a, you know, lightweight little SSH client for Windows.
Yeah, I mean, it's the SSH client for Windows until Microsoft started shipping, you know, the open source one with base Windows. So this bug is, if you use PuTTY to create digital signatures for a particular type of key, the NIST P521 elliptic curve key, then people who can see those signatures can recover your private key. Now, in the case of SSH, that's not really so bad because that those signatures are like inside the SSH auth process and you don't see it unless you're the server. So server can steal your private key, not great. Like SSH is not meant to make that happen, but, you know, not ultimately not terrible. You can't do it on the wire. But the other big use of this is for things like code signing. So if you're using GitHub and you're signing your commits to GitHub, then by design, those signatures are public. And so someone can harvest signatures off something like GitHub, and it requires about 60-ish to do this attack. And then they can recover your private key, sign commits as you, or log into computers that use SSH now with your private key. So it's a pretty bad bug. The Git use case is particularly concerning. There are some patches out from the PuTTY maintainer. But ultimately, you know, I've seen some criticism like this is a really dumb bug and this, you know, I can't believe this happened with PuTTY when it's so widely used. But if you read the gubbins of the bug, it's actually because Simon Tatham, the guy who writes PuTTY, implemented the algorithm that is currently, you know, kind of failing 15 years or something before the standard was done, because he was well ahead of the time in thinking about it, and his implementation was been fine since 2001, but fell apart because keys have kind of gotten a bit bigger than what he originally thought about. So the bug is not as dumb as it sounds, but the impact was still not great.
So the solution here is to go and revoke keys that were generated this way?
So, replace the keys, but it's less. It's not a bug in the generation. It's a bug in the signing using keys. So if you signed things with a key that you generated anywhere using this particular vulnerable curve with PuTTY, then you should rekey. But, yeah, it's not actual key generation that's the problem.
Yep, got it. Got it. Understood. Bugs in PuTTY. I didn't expect to be spending 5 minutes talking about a bug in PuTTY, like, ever. Really.
I mean, it's so widely used that it really, you know, it matters, right?
It is, man. PuTTY. And I always think, oh, PuTTY. You know? Like, that's always, that's the way everyone thinks of PuTTY, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it's just, it's one of those sort of fixtures that's been around our industry for so long that, yeah, it's got a degree of nostalgia around it, you know?
Yeah, it's almost like, oh, thank God someone made PuTTY, you know? Because it's like, honestly, you're on Windows, you got SSH into something, and like that, you know, pre-PuTTY you couldn't do, you could not do.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, PuTTY is, you know, it's one of those little gems in our history.
Now we're going to talk about something insanely stupid. And that's because this is a couple of stories from the land of cryptocurrencies and crypto exchanges and whatnot. This ex-Amazon security engineer has been jailed 3 years for stealing $12 million in cryptocurrencies, tokens, whatever. But the reason this one's interesting is because this guy hacked something called Crema and stole a bunch of money from him and then offered to return it if he could keep $1.5 million as like a white hat bounty. And my dude, that is not how white hatting works. They quite wisely, I think, called the police instead. And now he's going to prison for 3 years.
It is how white hatting works in the crypto world, where apparently, yeah, you can just show up, steal people's money, and then demand that they pay you to give it back. So I'm happy to see someone going to jail for this because it's a scourge that we have seen play out in a whole bunch of crypto systems, you know, over the last little while. And, you know, I don't want to see that normalized as a thing that people can do.
Just well, it's sort of like mugging someone and then offering to give their wallet back if you can keep 100, you know?
Yeah, like for a reward. Like, hey, I found your wallet that I just stole off you 10 seconds ago.
Your vulnerability was you didn't notice when I came up behind you and knocked you over the head with a lead pipe.
You weren't wearing a helmet when I decided to knock you over the head.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so I'm glad that somebody did not just fall for the scam, went to law enforcement, got this guy, now prosecuted and jailed. So, yay, good job.
I mean, one point you were making to me earlier is that quite often the reason these exchanges and whatever will pay a bounty is because it's funny money anyway. Like it's, you know, they're tokens or whatever that aren't really traded at any real depth and probably didn't really cost the people holding them anything, and you can just carve them off and give it to them, and there's no tangible loss. So that's perhaps one reason why they often play ball when people rack off with $10 million worth of a token and want to keep a mill.
Yeah, and you know, the hit to any one of these little crypto startups, if someone does steal all their stuff, is they go out of business. Giving away free money that didn't cost them anything to get it back is pretty attractive, and that's why people get away with shaking them down like this. So yeah. I'm just real glad that someone got some comeuppance for it once.
Yeah, yeah. And look, staying with crypto stuff, this guy here, what's his name? He's a Nebraska man. This one's from Dan Gooden over at Charles O. Parks III has been indicted because what he was doing was signing up to various cloud services, I think under, you know, fake or stolen identities, and then just, you know, doing epic crypto mining operations, mining stuff like Monero. But what's interesting about this is we got some numbers out of the indictment where it turns out he, you know, incurred costs of like $3.5 million to mine $1 million worth of cryptocurrency, which just goes to show you, like, you know, you really need an edge if you want to go do mining in this day and age, or you just, you know, you're going to be basically, yeah, spending $3.50 to make a dollar.
Yeah, it's just like the blatantness of this, of like, just sign up, don't pay a bill for a month because the, you know, bill doesn't come till the end of the month, and crypto mine. And it's probably just like, if it's Monero, it's probably CPU mining, which is why it's so extra inefficient.
But even just, if you're using an NVIDIA, right, you got your hardware cost and then your energy costs and everything.
Yeah, like. Yeah, it's almost like the whole crypto ecosystem is bunkum.
Yeah.
It's almost like...
Bracing for the email. Now, we're going to end this week with a Krebs on security story. I did actually see this one before he wrote it up. Doing the rounds on the old Twitter, which is since they changed the domain from Twitter to x.com, they did something hacky, which has resulted in funny bad stuff happening. I'm really setting this up badly, but Adam, walk us through this one because it's actually hilarious.
So Twitter is attempting to make it so that you don't see twitter.com, you see x.com, and so they are rewriting links that people post in tweets from twitter.com to x.com, or x.com to twitter.com, so that you can, you don't necessarily see that. But the net result of how they did this is that if you had a domain that ended in x.com, it got rewritten to twitter.com. So, for example...
No, the other way around. If you had one that ended in twitter.com, it would get rewritten to x.com.
Well, so on the display side, it gets rewritten to x.com.
Yes.
But on the actual click-through side, it's Twitter. So the example was like fedex.com. It would so if you had a link to fedtwitter.com, it would be displayed as fedex.com, but actually would link to fedtwitter.com.
Yes.
So... people have been going around registering, copycat domain names or whatever else that for domains that ended in x.com and then sticking a Twitter instead. So like space-twitter.com is SpaceX.
Yeah. And car-fat-twitter becomes Carfax.
Yes. Yeah. So like naive string replacing turned out wasn't perhaps the right way to deal with Earl rewriting their Twitter, which is just super dumb and embarrassing. They've now fixed it. But not before, there was a whole bunch of comedy and facepalming on x.com.
And you can totally see how this happened, which is Elon comes down to the skeleton crew that's remaining after like 75% layoffs and says, why am I still seeing twitter.com? Fix it or you're fired. And someone did this and then they all just moved on and forgot about it. Like, know that's what happened.
That is 100% how it went down. So
now, before we go to Martin Groten, pointed out that Orthodox Easter Sunday isn't actually until May 5. So we kind of got our timing a little bit funny when we were joking around about Orthodox Easter last week. But that means ransomware market might resume on Monday, May 6. Let's see.
Well, right? We'll have to see. I guess we'll look forward to that data point and see whether or not we were right or wrong or not at all.
Yeah. After everyone's done celebrating Easter with grandma, or observing Easter, I should say, with grandma. But yeah, we're going to wrap it up there. And there's no show next week. Well, there's no regular Risky Business next week. I'm taking the week off because it's school holidays. I'm going to hang out with my kids and, have some fun with them, which is going to be great. But we are running a podcast next week, and it's a new one. It's a new series that I'm very pleased to be able to announce right now. We've partnered up with SentinelOne to do a podcast with me, Alex Stamos, and Chris Krebs, because they both work over there now. So we don't really have a name for the podcast series yet, but we've recorded the first episode. It's edited. It's ready to go. So we're going to push that out instead of the regular weekly show next week. And the topic is all about technology and sovereignty and, how China, Russia, the United States all have different sort of supply chain concerns and whatnot. And it's about 45 minutes long. I found it very interesting. Adam, you edited that one actually. And, I know you heard it.
Yeah, it was, I really enjoyed it. Like, it's a great listen. And I don't know if we're going to call it Krebs, Stamos, Gray or what it's going to end up being, but it's a great listen. It's like 40 minutes of just like the sort of high level conversation about these big picture issues that I think we don't have enough of. So yeah, I think everyone who listens to the show will totally dig it. So yeah, look forward to it. Tune in your podcatcher for next week.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's just great to be able to do a podcast with Chris and Alex who, they've been regular appearances on the show over the years, and to be able to actually do a podcast with them is terrific. I think we're going to push out one of them about once a month for the next 6 months or so at least. So hope you all enjoy it. But yeah, that's it for the news, mate. Thank you so much for joining me, and we'll do it all again in 2 weeks.
Yeah, thanks so much, Pat. Enjoy your week off, and I will talk to you then.
That was Adam Boileau there with a check of the week's security news. It is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Jack Naglieri from Panther. And I guess you can think of Panther as like a modern Seam. You can throw an awful lot of data at it and run detection as code on all sorts of events and all sorts of data sources. And, this is just something that is like more contemporary if you had to simplify the description of them, it's like contemporary seam. But yeah, detection as code is the new hotness, and Panther is definitely at the forefront of making a platform that lets you do detection as code. So I started off by asking Jack about how people are actually using detection as code in the real world, and here's what he said.
It's not really about getting 100% coverage in the MITRE ATT&CK matrix. It's more about covering the tactics and techniques that are important for your company and like really doing a great job of covering those. So that's kind of like the first start, is like the mindset going into it is you have to know what's worth protecting, and then you have to work backwards from, okay, based on that, how could someone get in and cause harm? Okay. How do we work backwards from that and then figure out what data do we need to inform a correlation that would make that really reliable? Patterns that we're also seeing are incorporating more business logic and identity logic into rules. And I think it's a little bit more of a recent development. I think that prior, we would just have to hard code that into rules. Now, integrations are a lot better to where we can sort of build that into logic by default. So really pulling in the surrounding context from the organization, the historical context as well. And now that things are in data lakes and structured, we can do really interesting things, like obviously AI. Setting a lot of that up really just comes down to having great data. And once you have that data, you can start using all of these different bits and techniques to your advantage. So we're seeing like much more interesting combinations of these things, like deterministic correlations, looking across log streams, using LLMs to understand outputs. Like a lot of it really is collecting the right amount of evidence to have confidence, because analysis is not often black and white. I think that's what makes it really difficult, is it's all evidence-based. So what else can we look at that gives us confidence that this is actually right, versus in something like cloud security tends to be a bit more black and white. It's like this thing's vulnerable or it's not vulnerable. It is this version that we know is bad or it's not.
I mean, what's amazing to me is how much detection we've done until now, just on what you were saying about identities, is about how much identity information has been lacking and missing from these detections. And it is great to see this starting to sort of catch up. But it's kind of stunning, isn't it, that integration hasn't been there until recently?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think a lot of the reason that we took some time to lag behind is that we didn't even have good infrastructure baselines to really build on the volumes that we needed. So I remember, many, many years ago when I was working as a practitioner, we tried shoving an off-the-shelf SIM into our environment and just falls over because it can't even begin to handle the amount of data that we have. And this was, 8 years ago, 10 years ago.
Well, I think it's also that, environments are just so different, right? Like I remember having this conversation with someone very smart, like over a decade ago, and they're just like, well, it's very difficult to baseline what a network should look like because they're all such snowflakes.
Yes, they're all very unique. And I think this is why the promise of ML and security has been really challenging historically.
But I mean, shouldn't ML be the solution there, which is where it can come in and actually find a baseline for every individual environment?
Right, for every individual environment. But I think in the past, the approach of like, we train it on a common data set and roll it out.
Yeah.
We just see a lot of tools, even still in the wild, that aren't very reliable.
Yeah, that's...
Right.
Ain't that the case? I was thinking too that a pen tester buddy of mine a million years ago, there was one product he used to really like, which was actually a Rapid7 product called, I think it was User Insight or whatever. And it was really because it had that user analytics bit that it would correlate against other event information. And it's just funny that it was kind of like a small to medium enterprise targeted tool that he was just like, no, this is good. So here we are a decade later and, doing it properly at scale. So, you've talked about the type of information, you want to bring together, get it into one spot, put all that context there. Obviously once you've done that, you can start, correlating, right? You can start looking across different data sources and seeing when you've got a 5-alarm fire. What are the dead giveaway correlations that people are writing rules for at the moment?
Mm. Well, I mean, obvious ones are around, I think exfil is a very loud one, right? You see a bunch of data being accessed that is either somewhere very sensitive or just is a very high volume of access. Like that one's fairly simplistic to have pretty reliable results in. Looking at things like, I don't know, brute forcing in Okta is a very canonical example we throw around all the time, which isn't very interesting. It's like a bunch of failed logins and then a successful login. It's like, okay, yeah, something went wrong or someone really forgot their password. I think the more interesting ones come when you look across data sets, right? So it's like the failed login and successful login is not interesting, but then when you pair it with the exfil, it's like, oh, okay. So multiple points together are starting to happen. And then this goes back to what we were talking about MITRE, where you might look at one specific technique and then a sequential technique right after and sort of pair them together, right? Those types of correlations are really important and really helpful. And we see people talking about and building those a lot.
I mean, that's going to catch a lot of stuff, but I mean, there's always going to be the concern, isn't there, that an attacker is doing something that you just haven't, you know, set up a rule to detect in terms of like being able to correlate that particular sequence. Yeah. Or people slow down, right? So we've seen this in the past, right? People will do one step of an attack and sit there for 30 days and wait for the logs to flush and wait for the, you know, wait for the correlation window to drop off and then and continue. I mean, that's still a win because you're slowing them down, but you're not going to get everything this way, I guess is what I'm saying, right?
Yeah. I mean, the best attacks look like normal behavior, right?
Yeah. Or they look like one alert that gets buried, I guess is more my point, you know?
Yeah, there's obviously not a silver bullet. It's all about defense and detection in depth, right?
Yeah.
Like you want multiple signals to really like layer on top of each other to bubble things up that are interesting. And something that we've been talking about a lot on my own podcast as well, Detection at Scale, is really about this signaling concept, right? Because there's a lot of security relevant events that happen that we don't necessarily need alerts on, but we need to sort of tag and use for later. And the correlations that we've been building are really along that line of like thing that happens, we sort of tag it, put it to the side, and then we sort of create these like derived rules that look at all these various signals together in different ways. And that can help improve our ability to detect more than just like a singular like atomic rule, which is what we were doing for a long time.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, is that window, you know, is a delay useful to an attacker? Like that window concept that I was just talking about a moment ago. Are people still doing that to try to, you know, get around this sort of correlation? I'm guessing not, because most people are still just doing smash and grab, right?
Right. I was just, it's funny you say that. I just use that exact phrasing. Like a lot of attacks are just like quick smash and grab. We have access. We got to use it right now. Because the longer that they wait, the longer, you know, the potential it is for them to be discovered. So why lose that opportunity?
Yeah. I mean, probably the most enjoyable thing to watch, and I shouldn't say enjoyable, you know, it's very bad. It's crime. But the Lapsus smash and grab against Uber like a couple of years ago, that was just extraordinary, right? When, you know, they were making so much noise and everyone was watching them in there and, you know, that was a race to eviction. But wow, that's amazing how much damage they were able to do in such a short period of time.
Yeah, that one was brutal.
Yeah. Yeah. So can you think of any other sort of, I mean, you've given us a couple of great examples there, which is failed logins, then successful login, then exfil. You know, what are some other sort of sequences and steps that are generic enough to catch things that have a bit of variation in them, but also specific enough not to throw false positives at you?
I think another interesting one is combining security telemetry alerts with things that are probably appearing a bit more benign. So kind of combining this idea of like high and low signal things. So, layering, for example, additional logic into something like GuardDuty could be one. So GuardDuty can be helpful for certain types of attacks, and you might want to join that with some other thing that might appear benign on its own, but together are significant. So that pattern as well of like taking something that is one potentially reliable set of signal and combining it with something that's typically benign, and then together that becomes more relevant. And that's similar to what we see in like more like risk-oriented systems. They do similar things where they're looking at like the more bigger picture of what's happening to that particular identity.
Now, your customers are more likely to be sort of more at the cutting edge of SIEM, right? They're more likely to be your people who are comfortable taking all of this stuff, sticking it in a data lake and letting models crawl over it, as in the words of the head of security of Lyft, who was on the show a few weeks ago. And he didn't seem to think that was awesome, because it's there's a few questions around that when it comes to the you know, ML models crawling all over him, which is, you know, fair enough. But you know, just my question is, what sort of orgs are embracing this type of approach? Because we've been stuck in a Splunk world for so long that it's almost hard to imagine that it's going to change. And, you know, so what are the orgs that are starting to embrace this new way of doing things, of just pumping everything into one place and then doing the analytics there?
It's actually pretty surprising. We see orgs of all shapes and sizes, some bigger enterprises, some startups, some, you know, mid enterprise companies that were born in the cloud and continued on that way. But we tend to find that folks really want to get off of Splunk for a lot of the obvious reasons.
Ka-ching!
it costs a lot. But they, I think, rubbed a lot of people the wrong way after the acquisition, and were raising prices and things like that. So I think...
that's the playbook for an acquisition like that. I mean, it's not just Cisco who's going to do that, right? Yeah. Like, look at Broadcom and VMware. I think someone was on recently referred to the, you know, the license renewals. There, people are getting sticker shock.
Yeah, it's hard. And everyone's trying to be more efficient anyway. So it just adds, you know, salt in the wound in a lot of ways. But yeah, we see all different types of enterprises wanting the benefits of things like a security data lake, or just getting detection as code. And a lot of those things are hand in hand with each other, because you need well-structured data to do anything more interesting with security logs anyway. So,
are you starting to see much rip and replace, or is it mostly greenfields when people are doing this?
It's a combination. I think, to your point, like, not everything, you know, it's rare to be fully greenfield. But that's the easiest way to start. But we typically see like certain workloads that are more cloud oriented or super high scale starting with that is a common pattern.
Yeah, so they start where it makes sense, and then gradually it is going to eat the other stuff.
Yeah. It's funny. I was doing research and for a blog that I was writing this week, and they were talking about EPS limits in SIEMs, and I was like, wow, I haven't thought about that in so long. But it's still a real thing in some cases. So
yeah,
we just don't have that problem in cloud-based workloads, because things are auto-scaling, they're serverless. You don't think about it.
Yeah. And
that's what we want in every innovation cycle, right? We want...
I was going to say, I mean, like, maybe it's just modern, you know, and contemporary, like, and not based on ancient approaches.
Yeah.
All right, Jack Naglieri, thank you so much for joining us on the show to have a bit of a chat about, you know, really how practitioners are using detection as code to tick off a few, you know, solid detections. Very interesting stuff.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate the time.
That was Jack Naglieri there from Panther. Big thanks to Panther for sponsoring this week's show. And you'll be hearing from me next week in that wonderful podcast that I've recorded with Alex Stamos and Chris Krebs. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.